Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, September 9th, 2021. A third dose of vaccine against COVID-19 is limited to immunocompromised for now. By Abby Perot, ABBIE at BigBendSentinel.com. Far West Texas. Healthcare providers in Far West Texas have begun giving COVID-19 booster shots to immunocompromised people, and in anticipation of new federal guidance, many West Texas residents are looking to get a third dose booster to improve their immunity against the virus that has continued to infect, hospitalize, and kill Americans this summer. Last month, President Joe Biden announced a plan to roll out third dose boosters to the general public beginning September 20th. As the president's rollout draws near, state health officials and local providers say they are holding out for Food and Drug Administration approval of Pfizer and Moderna booster doses before moving forward on boosters for the general public. Pfizer and Moderna booster doses were approved by the FDA for immunocompromised people as of August 12th. And in the Big Bend region, some providers have already begun administering those. Sol Ross State University gave 130 shots of Pfizer and Moderna at a vaccine drive last Thursday, providing boosters for immunocompromised patients, along with first and second doses for the general public. The prescription shop and Highland Drug in Alpine both said this week that they are offering boosters of the Moderna vaccine for those who have weakened immune systems, and Walmart in Fort Stockton is offering Pfizer boosters to immunocompromised people. Preventative Care Health Services, which operates clinics in Presidio, Alpine, and Marfa, was unavailable to comment on their vaccine offerings. At the region's only hospital, boosters are not currently available for immunocompromised individuals, but Big Bend Regional Medical Center does plan to open a booster clinic later this month, pending recommendations of boosters for the general public by the CDC. Once the CDC guidance is clear, we will offer both third doses to immunocompromised and booster shots, hospital spokesperson Ruth Huck said. And information on how to sign up will be made available. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention began recommending a third dose of mRNA COVID-19 vaccines at least 28 days after a second dose of Pfizer or Moderna for people with moderate to severe immunocompromisation. That includes people receiving cancer treatments, organ transplant recipients who take immunosuppressant drugs, stem cell transplant recipients, moderate or severe primary immunodeficiency, such as DeGeorge syndrome, Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome, advanced or untreated HIV infection, and anyone receiving an active treatment with high-dose corticosteroids or other drugs that may suppress your immune response. CDC recommendation is that the additional dose be the same vaccine as the first two doses they received. People should talk with their personal physician or healthcare provider about whether they should receive an additional dose, a spokesperson for the Texas Department of State Health Services said this week. For those who received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, studies are ongoing, but there is not yet enough data about whether they would benefit from an additional dose, the DSHS spokesperson said. There have been hiccups since Biden announced a September 20th rollout date for boosters to the general public. The FDA has not yet said it is safe and useful to have a third dose, and the CDC has not recommended the booster. Last Friday, officials from the two government agencies, speaking anonymously, told the New York Times that at first, boosters for the general public may only be available to people who received the Pfizer vaccine. With 11 days until the planned start date, trial data for the Pfizer Comirnaty vaccine is still under review by the FDA, and an advisory committee meeting isn't scheduled until September 17th. Data review from Moderna's third dose trials are further behind. The Pfizer vaccine has received full FDA approval, while Moderna is still being administered under an emergency use authorization, which may inform which booster is available first. A transparent, thorough, and objective review of the data by the FDA is critical so that the medical community and the public continue to have confidence in the safety and effectiveness of COVID-19 vaccines, the FDA wrote in a news release on September 1st. The FDA will review the supplemental application as expeditiously as possible, while still doing so in a thorough and science-based manner. According to the White House plan, people who aren't immunocompromised and who have received two doses of Pfizer or Moderna would be eligible for a third booster dose of their vaccine 8 months after receiving their second dose. By sticking to that schedule, those who were highest risk and eligible earliest when the vaccines first rolled out would also be the first to get the booster dose. Since December 2020, Tri-County healthcare workers have administered more than 21,800 doses of the Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson vaccines to residents in the area. While the bulk of those vaccinations took place in the spring of 2021, each of the three counties in the area saw slight increases in vaccination starting after the first week of July, coinciding with news of the Delta variant spreading. Sol Ross State University is planning to offer monthly vaccine events as long as turnout remains high, said SRSU's Mike Pacheco, the chief of staff in the office of the president. While the school is planning another vaccine event in late September, they will give first and second doses to anyone, but only give third boosters to immunocompromised people unless guidance from the CDC changes and opens the booster up to the general public. The vast majority of the Tri-County's vaccinated general population do not yet qualify for a booster, even if it were approved for the general public, since 8 months have not elapsed since their second dose. And while some Tri-County residents are eager to get a third dose to boost their immunity against COVID-19, for now, only immunocompromised West Texans can get vaccinated with a third dose. Border enforcement and international commerce among key topics discussed during Representative Gonzalez's visit to Presidio County. By Abby Perot, ABBIE at BigBendSentinel.com. Presidio County. Freshman U.S. Representative Tony Gonzalez made a whistle-stop tour through West Texas last week, meeting with over a dozen Presidio County officials to give, quote, a little update of what's happening in Washington, in the state, and in the district, end quote, Gonzalez said Wednesday. In his brief visit, he spoke with officials about Afghanistan, the border, and bringing money into the district, and then local officials brought forward their own concerns from on the ground in West Texas. Gonzalez, who served in Afghanistan for 5 years, said that the U.S. withdrawal from the war-torn country was very personal, and it's been a rough couple weeks to see how things have been handled. The representative called for more transparency on the drawdown as well as the recent resettlement of refugees in nearby El Paso's Fort Bliss. He supported vetting those refugees, saying, "We need to know who's coming into this country, but this is America. It's the land of opportunity." Transitioning to another type of migration, Gonzalez stated, "The border has not gotten any better. You see that with the sheer number of traffic that's coming through. Beyond the migrant situation, what worries me the most is a national security threat." He alluded to classified briefs that should keep you up at night, saying, "What worries me the most is a small bomb, biological bomb, all kinds of threats that are real that could happen." He told local officials in the county judge's office in the courthouse, "It's not this made-up Tom Clancy novel. It's real. It's happening." Gonzalez took a similar tack as former U.S. Representative Will Hurd, who called for a technology-based border wall rather than a physical one. "We need a wall, a barrier, a natural barrier. We need technology behind it, sensors, drones, blimps, some sort of technology. And the third thing we need is boots on the ground." He proposed adding more agents and more technologies like sensors that detect movement and notify Border Patrol. 10 towers have already been installed around Presidio. Presidio City Administrator Brad Newton told Gonzalez, showing him a photo of a surveillance tower. "When you're in Presidio, you're on camera," added Judge Cinderella Guevara. "We've got a wall that talks to us, and we're not giving up the Rio Grande and Mexico by fencing this off," Newton said. "Good job to Will Hurd, who started this, and I hope you pick up and start using this to secure the border." Similar to his approach to Afghan refugees, Gonzalez called for a focus on improving legal immigration paths. "A lot of folks can circle behind that, and the reality is we have a lot of labor shortages in all kinds of industries throughout." Local officials responded eagerly to talks about improving conditions at the Presidio border. Newton asked for more personnel at the port of entry, citing the growing hours-long wait times at the bridge. "Basically, they don't have enough hands," Newton asserted. "Presidio, we've got the housing there, so there's no reason not to add personnel there." County and City of Presidio Attorney Rod Ponton also asked for port improvements, saying officials wanted a new port in their budget this coming year. "All it needs is you to bring us about $150 million," Ponton said. "That's all?" Gonzalez jokingly replied. Ponton explained that port traffic and a lack of cold storage has recently led Mexican farming operations to reroute a share of their harvests through the McAllen port in South Texas, rather than put up with the Presidio port. Justice of the Peace Juanita Bishop chimed in to flag another issue at the crossing. The persistent closure of the border to Mexicans during the pandemic led Bishop to say, "I think it's hurting the economy in Presidio." Gonzalez said he shared the concern. "I've been pushing on the federal administration to secure the border, but I've also been pushing on the administration to open up the border for commerce and traffic for those that have the proper documentation to shop, go to the hospital, do all those different things." The representative also praised the vaccine against COVID-19, adding that he has been advocating for vaccines in the U.S. and for communities along the U.S.-Mexico border, saying, "A lot of times those communities are one." When Gonzalez opened up the floor for questions or comments, Newton asked Gonzalez's office to help administer grants. Even as areas like Presidio and Marfa become eligible for federal funds, the smaller towns struggle to find someone qualified and available to administer those programs. "There's a lot of money out there, And sadly, a lot of communities don't know how to reach that money, Gonzalez said. He referenced his office having a dedicated staff member that helps share information about federal economic development and infrastructure grants. Judge Gravata shared that the county is planning to pursue a $5 million grant for the city of Presidio to get an emergency clinic built, and Gonzalez offered to write a letter of support for the project if it came across his desk. A large part of me coming out here today is I am looking for partners, Gonzalez told officials from Marfa, Presidio, the county, and various emergency response departments. I'm looking for people that want to put all the other things that are happening aside and go, what are some tangible, meaningful things we can get done? Staff photo by Maisie Crow. Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guevara accompanies U.S. Congressman Tony Gonzalez, R. Texas 23, during last week's Marfa High School homecoming parade. Gonzalez visited Presidio County to meet local officials who were eager to talk about the impacts of border enforcement and struggles of international commerce in Presidio County. Photo by Sarah M. Vasquez. As the 34th Annual Marfa Lights Festival neared a close, Marfa resident P.J. Serrano proposed to Sonia Murillo during La Fiebre's set on Saturday night. She said yes. Marfa Lights comes back after COVID, reuniting families near and far. By Sachi McClendon, SACHI at BigBendSentinel.com. Marfa, the 34th Annual Marfa Lights Festival went off without a hitch over Labor Day weekend, despite some of the organizers' worries that it might not be able to handle this year due to the Delta variant of the coronavirus spiking the number of positive cases throughout the state. I joined the chamber in early July, and we weren't even sure the festival was going to happen at that point, so we had a really short time to make it happen, said Abby Boyd, the president of the Chamber of Commerce, which organized the event. Of course, if there had been anything that came up where we had to stop it to protect the community, we would have done that at any point. But at some point, we just had to go for it and hope for the best, Boyd said, adding that if there were any theme to this year's festival, it was simply to make sure that it happened. Over the span of 2 days, there were bands and DJs playing all day long and going well after 11 p.m. in front of the county courthouse. Some of the performers were local groups like Make Up Sex, Primo Carrasco and Hector Sanchez, and Marfa ISD Ballet Folklorico Aztlan. On Saturday, a parade celebrating all things Marfa slowly made its way from the elementary school to kick off the day's festivities. Those in attendance could see floats from organizations based in the area, like the Chamber of Commerce and Big Bend Community Action Committee, as well as floats, or at least vehicles, celebrating emergency response personnel, like the Marfa and Fort Davis Volunteer Fire Departments. Even Rod Ponton, in his role as county attorney, made an appearance, throwing candy out the back of his truck. I think this event, in particular, is really about tradition. It's about Marfa and the Marfa community, so we wanted to go with what's always worked for this festival. We stuck to the tried and true things, which bring great bands from the area and afar in Texas that we think our Marfa residents will love, so they can come about and be entertained, Boyd said. Boyd, who considers Marfa Lights her favorite event in town, says that the parade in particular reflects the residents that live in Marfa. It celebrates this town and the people who make it up, not the Marfa that you see on Instagram. It celebrates our place in the world. You can see that in the parade, where we have Genevieve Basham, who's been a longtime resident of Marfa, a former mayor, former city council person. She runs the Marfa Food Pantry. She's a descendant of the Jamano people. That may be Humano, Boyd said. Staff photo by Maisie Crow. Genevieve Basham, a former Marfa mayor and city council person, leads the 34th annual Marfa Lights Parade as its Grand Marshal. Basham, who is a descendant of the Jamano people, was followed by a long line of parade participants, including members of the Jamano tribe during their first time participating in the event. Marfa residents Elizabeth Farrell and Zeke Rainey dance during the Grand Tourists performance Saturday evening at the 34th Annual Marfa Lights Festival. Photo by Sarah M. Vasquez. It's everything you hope a small town festival will be. I think it's a lot about the real Marfa. Basham, who was this year's Grand Marshal, riding in a convertible at the head of the parade, said she was impressed by how many organizations participated in the celebration. We were in front leading the parade. We were going slow, but at the same time, I turned around and it was a long line, she said. I couldn't even see the end of it. Basham said it was nice to see the Jamano tribe, of which she is a member, have a float in the parade. I think that was the first time they participated, she said. David Chavez has been coming every year since he moved here in the 1990s to become city manager, albeit for only a short while. He said, of course, Marfa Lights diminished in size a lot. It used to be quite an event, but just like everything else in Marfa, the population has declined. The opportunities for young people have declined. After they graduate, it's a mass exodus somewhere else. You gotta go where the jobs are. Yet, for Boyd, that's what makes Marfa Lights so special, as it serves as a homecoming for those that have left town. I saw a lot of people's sons, nephews, and cousins reuniting. I saw people with family reunion t-shirts on, she said. I know a lot of the members of the chamber who've lived here, born and raised here, had family in town that they don't get to see all the time. I think a lot of people make this their annual family reunion. There was even a marriage proposal at the La Fiebre show on Saturday, in which P.J. Serrano asked Sonia Murillo to be his wife. We met a little over 4 years ago. We made plans to meet up that weekend and go to Marfa Lights. It just so happened that La Fiebre was playing that weekend, and we shared our first dance together at the Marfa Lights, Serrano said. Though I was nervous, I still asked without skipping a beat, he said. As far as I know, I am the only one to get on stage in front of thousands and ask someone to marry them during Marfa Lights weekend. And overall, Boyd said that Marfa Lights went over about as well as she could have hoped for. We weren't sure at the beginning because of COVID, what the turnout would be like or what the community response would be. But in the end, we got a lot of positive feedback from the attendees, and we got a lot of support from the community, and we are super grateful for that, Boyd said. I think next year, hopefully when things are a little more clear, hopefully we will have more time for strategic thinking on this next one.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan's News for Thursday, September 2nd. School taxes to go down approximately $40 yearly. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. Property taxes for residents living within the boundaries of the Monahans Wicket Pyote ISD will see a decrease both in the tax rate and total taxes to be assessed. That action was taken during Monday night's meeting of the Board of Trustees. The trustees also approved a budget of $33,500,000. The new tax rate will be a total of $1.07 per $100 of property valuations. The tax rate is comprised of 93 cents to support the maintenance and operation budget and 14 cents for the interest and sinking fund for the 2019 bonds. Although property values have increased, the lower overall tax rate will result in a decrease in taxes of $41.86 per year. The average market value for the residences has increased from $97,000 to $101,000, but the taxes due on the average residence as the result of the tax will go from $650 per year to $608, a drop of $41 per year. The tax decrease is driven by the reduction in the interest and sinking tax rate as the result of the early retirement of 2006 and 2013 school bonds, leaving the only bond indebtedness for the 2019 $140 million bond passed by voters in May 2019. This resulted in a drop in the INS rate from 29 cents to 14 cents. The M&O rate of 93 cents is the same as last year. The taxes based on the total appraised value within the district dropped this year from $3.2 billion to $2.8 billion. The total budget is $40,800,000, which includes $38,800,000 in revenue and a forward fund balance of $1.9 million. Budgeted expenditures are instruction $13,600,000, instructional support $4.4 million, central administration $761,000, district operations $6.4 million, debt service $6.4 million, and other $8.3 million. The trustees passed both the new tax rate and the budget for 2021-2022. Architect R.J. Lopez of Park Hill updated the trustees on the current status of bond projects in progress throughout the district. Lopez said Walker Junior High classes were completed in 2020 and secure entries at Walker, Cullender, and Tatum were completed in August. Quote, "We are essentially complete with these projects and are now in the warranty phase, and there will be minor issues that will be corrected as they come up," he said. The bus barn is scheduled for completion in March 2022 and the new elementary school in August 2022. High school Phase 1 completion is May 2022, Phase 2 completion August 2022, Phase 3 August 2023, athletics completion in 2023. Quote, "Some schedules have slipped because of COVID and delays in receipt of materials, but we're still on budget," he said. Superintendent Chad Smith presented the district enrollment reports. The total enrollment is 2,098 students as of August 26th, which is 65 students above the last day of school on May 27th. Monahans High School has the largest increase with an additional 67 students, followed by Walker Junior High with 24 additions. Tatum Elementary is up by 18 students, and Cullender Kindergarten is up by 9. Sudirth Elementary is down by 39 students, and Monahans Education Center is down by 14 students. The first integrity rating system of Texas was also presented by Smith. The district received a score of 96 out of a possible 100 points, which is considered superior achievement. Smith also told the trustees the district will be regarding the receipt from TEA to proceed with tax rate adoption process to purchase attendance credits as the method for making recapture payments. monthly financial and disbursement reports, as presented by business manager Sarah Harris, was approved. As of July 31st, $31.2 million has been collected in taxes for the Maintenance and Operations Fund, with $485,000 still to be collected. For the Interest and Sinking Fund, $9.9 million has been collected, with $154,000 remaining to be collected. The cash position statement, also as of July 31st, reflects $105,000 cash in the bank and $47.6 million in investments. Disbursements for July were $1.7 million. Leading items were instructional, $989,000, plant maintenance and operation, $208,000, school administration, $113,000, and co-curricular extracurricular, $91,000. For the 2019 bond funds, the beginning balance was $140 million. As of July 31st, expenditures were $41.0 million, and $1.5 million has been earned in interest, leaving funds available at $100.5 million. The Hall of Honor Lobos for Life were announced for this year. Dexter Nichols was named as the alumni recipient. Bren Holland was named as the extracurricular employee recipient. Doug Ward was named as the employee recipient. And Brett Heflin was named as the supportive community member recipient. They will be inducted in a special ceremony on September 25th at the Walker High School Junior High Auditorium. Ward County 4-H Extension agents were approved as adjunct faculty members for this school year. The Agriculture Natural Resources agent is Kaylee Gillespie, and the Family, Community, and Health agent is Haley Lacaz. In other actions, the trustees approved the Texas Teacher Evaluation and Support System, approved the teacher appraisal calendar for the 2021-2022 school year, and reviewed the district mission statement and goals for the current school year. As an adjunct faculty member, students involved in the 4-H activities away from school will not be counted as absent. The request for 4 teachers administrators to live out of district was approved. Those approved were Pete Laura of Monahans High School, Ashley Atram and Hattie Hirado at Walker Junior High, and Toy Eaton and Geraldine Bookmiller at Sudirth Elementary. The trustees approved a resolution that will grant the extension of leave of 10 COVID days for employees who either test positive or who have voluntarily quarantined due to close contact during the current school year. The trustees recognize students who have advanced past district competition. Zach Burkett and Mackenzie Burkett were both national champions in the Skills USA competitions. Hope Santiago and Zach Carter were multiple medal winners in adaptive sport competitions for athletes with physical disabilities in the Move United Junior Nationals held in Colorado. Trustees present were Bobby Almanza, Quint Melius, Donna Garcia, Raymond Elms, Joel Greiner, Nancy Upchurch, and Steve Fine. The next meeting of the trustees will be held on September 20th at 6:30 p.m. in the School Administration Building at 606 South Betty Street. Calendar closed due to staff with COVID. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Calendar Kindergarten is taking steps to get the increase of COVID cases at the campus under control. In an attempt to stop the spread of the coronavirus among staff, Calendar Principal Jeannie Jackson announced in a statement on Tuesday, quote, Calendar will be closed to students from Wednesday, September 1st, until Monday, September 6th. Classes will resume on September 7th, end quote. Quote, we have very few students out with COVID, but out of the 9 teachers on campus, 5 of them are out, Superintendent of Schools Chad Smith said. There are 2 additional staff members also out sick. Quote, the alternative to closing the campus for a week was to combine classes, and we felt this was a better way to handle the situation, he added. Smith added, quote, each campus is being monitored for absences of staff and students, and action to close a campus will be addressed as the need arises, end quote. The remaining teachers and staff will be on campus next week and will communicate with students each day. COVID cases still up, but starting to decline. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. COVID-19 cases remain high in Ward County, but have dropped slightly since Sunday evening. According to data from the Texas Department of State Health Services, there were 153 active cases on Wednesday morning, down from 169 on Sunday, but there were 110 cases last Tuesday. The death count attributable to COVID remains at 24. Since the start of the pandemic last year, there have been 917 confirmed cases, 537 probables, with 1,279 recoveries. Quote, active cases in Ward County represent about 2% of the population has tested positive or been determined to probably have the virus at one time or another, County Judge Craig Holly said. Across the state, there is now 3 million confirmed cases, 567,000 probable, with 55,365 deaths. The current count of active cases is now 273,000 and 3.2 million recoveries. Ward Memorial Hospital reported a total of 14 patients on Wednesday morning, 8 of which are COVID. Holly explained the difference between isolation and quarantine. The period of isolation may end after all 3 have occurred. 1. 10 days since symptoms first appeared. 2. 24 hours with no fever. And 3. Other symptoms of COVID-19 are improving. If no symptoms were present at all, then isolation may end 10 days after the positive test. The term quarantine is for those who have been in close contact with someone with COVID-19, such as within 6 feet for a cumulative 15 minutes or more over a 24-hour period. The guidance varies depending on whether or not you've been vaccinated or have recently recovered. Pecos juvenile charged with manslaughter. The story was written by Rosie Flores. Family, friends, and community members gathered at Maxey Park on Monday to bid farewell to 14-year-old Mariah Grace Garcia, who died a few days after she was struck by a vehicle in a hit-and-run on North Hickory Street. The group gathered for a candlelight vigil in honor of Garcia, where they shared stories, listened to testimony, comforted each other, and listened to Garcia's favorite music. Garcia died on Monday, August 16th, at an El Paso hospital from injuries she suffered from a vehicle accident. On Thursday, August 12th, officers with the Pecos Police Department were dispatched to the 900 block of North Hickory Street in reference to a hit and run, according to Pecos Police Chief Lisa Tarango. Officer located a juvenile female in the roadway with serious injuries. The responding officers assisted EMS in providing emergency care, Tarango said. During the initial investigation, 3 subjects were identified. 1 juvenile was identified as the driver, and 2 other juveniles were identified as witnesses. Garcia was airlifted to an El Paso hospital for medical care, but died Monday morning. Tarango stated that on August 20th, the Pecos Police Department arrested two juveniles in connection with the accident. One juvenile has been charged with manslaughter, a second-degree felony, while the second juvenile was charged with false report to a police officer, a Class B misdemeanor. Chief Tarango stated that the investigation is ongoing at this time. Anyone who may have further information regarding the investigation is encouraged to contact the Pecos Police Department at 432-445-4911. Since all the individuals involved are juveniles, the police department is not going to release any names because by law, the names cannot be released. And being that these are juveniles, there is no bond set and they were placed into custody of the juvenile justice system and will be held until subsequent hearings are held, according to Tarango. The charges are being determined by the juvenile prosecution, who will ultimately have the responsibility of the future prosecution of the case. Quote, "This is a very difficult case, and although we have tried to release what we can, it is a very sensitive case," said Tarango. Two booked for oil field theft in Odessa. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A two-month-long oil field theft investigation by the Ector County Sheriff's Office and the oil field theft section of Odessa ended last week with the arrest of two Monahans men. David Lawrence Haynes, age 41, of Monahans, was arrested by Ector County Sheriff's Office deputies as he was exiting the neighbor's drilling calibration yard at 13,000 West University in the early morning hours of Saturday, August 21st. According to the Ector County Sheriff's Office, quote, "Haynes had in his possession stolen copper cable, a cable cutting tool, and heroin. This affected three drilling rigs in the neighbor's drilling yard. Cutting the generator cable on each rig caused a total of approximately $345,000 in damages as the cable was no longer serviceable, causing the entire drilling rig to require rewiring," end quote. During the course of the two-month investigation, Sean Lee Broderick, age 44, of 1305 South Allen Street, was identified as an additional suspect. A warrant was issued for his arrest, and he was subsequently arrested on August 27th in Monahans by Ward County Sheriff's Office deputies. Broderick was charged with criminal mischief, a first-degree felony. Haynes was booked at the Ector County Detention Center and charged with theft of regulated material, a state jail felony, evading arrest, Class A misdemeanor, resisting arrest, a Class A misdemeanor, possession of heroin, a state jail felony, and criminal mischief, a first-degree felony. Haynes' bonds total $62,500 for all charges. Broderick's bond was set at $50,000. Broderick has since been transferred to Ector County Detention Center, and both individuals remain in custody in lieu of posting their bonds. It is not clear as of press time if additional charges are pending.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.